Ja, gute Woche. Some questions at the end of last week's show came up regarding Shaul HaMelech and how that fits in with the picture we were talking about. I thought to dedicate a show or maybe a couple of shows into the subject of Shaul HaMelech. So I'm just notifying that Bezos Hashem that's on the agenda, but we're not going to do that this week. Could be next week. Let's see. I have two things I'd like to cover this week, kind of like two sides of the same coin. Let's see how the rule is that you cover about a third of what you expected to. So let's see how things go. Let's talk about the beginning of Shoftim. Shoftim opens up. I'm sorry, I'm just going to open it up. Shoftim begins. Now, if we spoke about this, just speak up and we'll move to the other side of the coin. But Shoftim begins with right after the passing of Yeshua. And Yeshua was Nifter in the middle of the conquest, in the middle of the Eretz Yisrael had not been entirely conquered yet. There was still more to be done, but he was Nifter. Now, the Shvatim were. Where do we go from here? Now, for whatever reasons, it was also going to be different. After Yeshua was Nifter, in his lifetime, all of Klal Yisrael fought as one body. But at this point, for whatever reasons, it was going to have to move into a different reality where each Shevet was going to be responsible for conquering that area. So now the question was, the Shoftim begins with the question of Klal Yisrael wondering which Shevet should be the one to take up the next battle. This was an important question, the Mefarshim say. I mean, what difference does it make? Everyone's going to have to be fighting their battle, whatever it is. But no, the Mefarshim say that this was a critical question because there was a question of morale at this point. As long as Yeshua was alive, the conquests were amazing, supernatural. And now that he was Nifter, the question is what's going to happen now? And here, the concern was that if the first battle after he's Nifter won't be a smashing success, then it'll both boost the morale of the Kananim and lower the morale of the Bnei Yisrael, which can have a big impact on the fighting in terms of planning it b'derech hateva. They were certainly relying on a lot happening l'mala b'derech hateva, but this was an important question in terms of planning the continuation. So this was an important question that needed to be decided. So they consulted with the Urim v'Tumim. And what was the response? Vayomer Hashem, Yehuda Yale. Yehuda should be the next one to go up to fight. Okay. Now I want to move on to a little bit further in the Perek. I'm not getting into the particulars of what happened. When you move on a little bit in the further in the Perek, it almost becomes monotonous. Okay, Yehuda went ahead. They smote the Kenani and the Perizi in Bezek. Okay, we'll go a little further. It starts getting monotonous until you read the continuation of how it worked with the other Shvatim, and then you suddenly understand that monotone was actually very significant. From Pasuk Ches, it says, Yehuda battled against Yerushalayim. They conquered it. They smote it by sword. They set the city on fire. Then they went down to fight the Kanani who were sitting in the mountains and the Negev and the Shvela, the lowlands. Then they went to the Kanani sitting in Hebron, which used to be called Kiryas Arba, and they smote Sheshai and Achimon and Talmai. Then they went to Dvir, which used to be called Kiryas Sefer. Okay, a whole little incident there. Fine. But whatever it is, Vaita. They went on. And they Othniel ben Kenaz smote that. Then they went on, and they smote the Kenani who were settled in Tzfas. They called the city Chorma. Then they went on and they conquered Aza, right? And its territories, Ashkelon, Ekron. Hashem was with Yehuda, and they drove the residents of the mountain, whichever mountain it was, out of there. There was a certain valley that they could not overcome. There was a little pocket that remained there. Okay, fine.
Was that an outcome?
No. That seems to be already after we've moved on. Okay. Then we move on to the next. So you move through this. It's like kind of like monotonous. They smoke this, they smoke this, they smoke this, they smoke this. When does it become interesting, this monotone? When you move on to the next shvatim. And note the contrast. Binyamin did not drive out the Yevusi who was settled in Yerushalayim. And the Yevusi ended up settling amongst the Bnei Yisrael and Yerushalayim until this very day. They remain pockets of the Yevusi. Yevusi, Yevusi.
It says Adayim
It says Adayim Hazeh. Yeah, Adayim Hazeh means until the time that this was written. Okay. Then we have Yosef, again, a little incident, but how does it continue? Menashe did not drive everybody out of Beit Shan and its suburbs, nor out of Tanakh and its suburbs. And the same goes for Yishveh Dor, Yivlaam, the Gidoi, and the Kanani ended up staying settled in that area. As Yisrael grew stronger, they ended up making the Kanani into tributaries, but they didn't chase them out. That's Menashe. Ephraim did not drive out the Kanani who were settled in Gezer, and the Kanani ended up settling within them. Again, pockets of Kanani and Gezer. Zvulun did not drive out everybody who was in Kitron or Nahalal. Okay. Asher did not drive out. From there until the end of the Shvatim, we basically have the descriptions of who didn't drive out which areas. And now you go back and you look back at Yehuda, and all of a sudden it's a whole different tone. They smote, they smote, they smote, they smote, they smote. This also makes you understand why Hashem said it should be Yehuda first. So now let's appreciate what's actually going on here. There is an undertone. You get to the end of the Perek, we have Yehuda who just went like dominoes, and then they didn't get these ones out, they didn't get these ones out, they didn't get these ones out. Perek Beis begins and says, now let's just get back into the reality. Hashem wanted the seven nations driven out of Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, this was going to be a process. This wasn't going to happen overnight. I've never been in battle, but I imagine that after you finish a battle, you need a few days break. You can't, finish the battle at 9 in the evening and then be up at 7 in the next morning on to the next battle. Obviously, this is a process that will have to be done with a certain pace. Hashem wanted it to happen. But it's self-understood that it's going to have to be according to a human pace. The Shvatim gave themselves more of a pace than Yehuda did. Yehuda gave themselves much less slack. They were tuck, 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 tuck. Whereas the Shvatim allowed themselves a little bit more slack, a little bit more space, a little bit more breathing room. Which again, it makes sense, right? But then what happens? How fast does Hashem want it to happen? There wasn't a very clear date or deadline given. Hashem expected them to make it happen. And here we're seeing that they didn't finish the job here, they didn't finish the job there. What happens in Perek Beis?
How do you know they went slow? You said they didn't finish, but how do you know they went slower than they should have?
So let's see. Let's see. That's as it emerges from the continuation, from Perek Beis. Perek Beis, it says, a Malach of Hashem, a messenger of Hashem, presumably useless, Pinchas, came with a message for the Bnei Yisrael. He says, I took you out of Mitzrayim. I brought you into this land that I swore to your forefathers. And I said that I would never cancel my bris with you. And I told you not to reach any agreements with the people living in this land. Smash all of their mizbeches. And you didn't listen. What have you done? And therefore, Hashem says, it's kind of like, if you're told you have a certain amount of time to do something and suddenly the bell rings, you weren't ready for it. Hashem says, I was waiting for it to happen. The bell is ringing now. At this point, you're not going to be able to get them out. At this point, since you didn't get the job done up till now, I'm not going to enable you to get them out. They're going to be a thorn in your side from now on. And their gods are going to be a mikshol for you. say that in English. It's English as far as I'm concerned.
Trap.
What's
Some
that?
trap.
Trap, stumbling blocks, traps. That's right. That's right. All of Bnei Yisrael wept. They called the place Boichim. That's actually named the place Boichim after the weeping that went on there. They brought Karbanis to Hashem to try to be mechaper for their failing. But that's it. This reality was now locked in. And here, we already had now starting the period in Eretz Yisrael is already starting with an imbalance. Yehuda's territory is clean. The rest of the Bnei Yisrael have all these different pockets. Why was it so urgent for Hashem that everybody be driven out? Because Hashem wanted the environment in Eretz Yisrael to be sterile. The only values one is exposed to, the only concepts one is exposed to, are the Torah value systems. Everything else is something that might exist in theory somewhere else, but nothing you've ever encountered in your life. We don't appreciate this point because we are coming at the tail end, at the end of 2,000 years of Golos, where we've been living with the Ummus HaOlam. We've been exposed to their world. We've been exposed to their value system. And it's very hard to even be aware of quite how much its influence infiltrated our consciousness and our lives. But this is what Hashem was trying to avoid. We don't know what to be able to appreciate what it means to really be living in a sterile environment that's completely governed by only Torah values. If that's all that there is, everybody is in a much higher, purer place. And this is what Hashem wanted for Klal Yisrael. And this is why Hashem said Yehuda should go first, with the intention that Yehuda, with their drive, would be a model for the rest of Bnei Yisrael. And what were the effects of this fact? The effects of this fact were that the rest of the Shvatim were infected with sources of foreign influence from the very beginning. Whereas Yehuda started off in the way Hashem actually intended, with an absolutely sterile environment where all anybody was exposed to was Torah standards. And what was the effect of that head start that Yehuda got? The effect of that was that the real infection of Avodah Zarah started in the rest of the Shvatim much earlier than it started in Yehuda. At the end, it infiltrated into all areas of Eretz Yisrael, and that culminated with the Churban Bayis Rishon. But the infection started spreading. It started becoming much more problematic among the Aseres HaShvatim, whereas with Yehuda, it took much longer. And even when it did, it remained smaller, more controlled. Bezras Hashem, we'll have opportunity, I hope, to actually study what happened when, as far as Yehuda goes. And this was all the effect of the fact that Yehuda, right at the beginning, energetically went ahead and completely purified and purged their land of any foreign influence. Just to cite one example, the story of Pelegesh B'Givah, the story of Pelegesh B'Givah, very tough subject. It's a subject that really deserves its own attention. But what was the gist of the subject? The gist of the subject was that those were already the first, the beginnings of those pockets of foreign presence that remained in Eretz Yisrael started having their effect. What happened? There were pockets of Canaanim who had their ways. And the weaker fringe elements of the youth of Binyamin saw those things. And in one situation that presented itself, they said, let's try that too. And that led to a situation of those days, Bnei Israel responded. They understood what was happening. It almost led to the complete wiping out of all of Shevet Binyamin. And that's, again, it's a story that deserves its own study. But the point is that Hashem wanted a reality where all you see, all you know, there are things that might exist in the outside world, but it's something you've never ever encountered, and therefore it's outside of your consciousness. Now, how is this relevant to us? The reason it's relevant to us is because whatever we can do to try to reinstate that pure air, the pure environment of where all we know is Torah values, the higher we'll be raising our lives, the higher we'll be raising our families. If we just note a couple of examples of this, or we'll approach this from another angle. We'll approach this from another angle in order to really try to bring out quite how the significance of this point. People tend to downplay the effect that your surroundings have on you. There's this tendency to think, I have a spine, I have my moral backbone, and it's okay, I can be exposed. But it isn't true. It's not human nature. The mind is a very vulnerable thing. And even we're not talking about people suddenly going and behaving in the ways that they're exposed to, but it becomes part of the frame of reference. It becomes part of the frame of reference. Let's show how it looks in the extreme, to the positive direction, to the extreme. And here we're jumping to another area in Nach. In the first battle that the Bnei Israel had when they came into Eretz Yisrael was famously in Yericho. That was the first battle they had. And Yeshua beforehand had said he had imposed an oath on the Bnei Israel that nobody is going to take anything from the spoils. What happened? They wiped out the city and the spoils were left untouched all over Yericho, untouched. Amazing success. Huh?
The second one,
Oh,
like an album
so
song.
that's like an Abram son, right. An amazing success. If you think about it, any army that can come afterwards and say that all the soldiers, everything just remained as is, that's an unbelievable discipline. They went to the next battle, the battle at Ai, and there they suffered a shocking loss. There shouldn't have been any losses in the way the battles of Bnei Israel were going. They suffered a shocking loss. And Yeshua is shocked. Says Hashem, what happened? What had happened? It turned out that one person had taken a little gold and a certain fabric, right? And that was it. And he hid it, he buried it in his tent. One person. And what? How is that expressed by Hashem? How is that expressed by Hashem? The lesson of the pasuk is, Yeshua comes and asks Hashem, why did this happen? So Hashem tells him, the lesson is, one minute. Chato Yisrael. Sorry. Yeah. So first the pasuk says the Bnei Yisrael transgressed the oath. Achan took XYZ. Okay, fine. And then when Yeshua actually asks what happened, so Hashem tells him, Chata Yisrael. Yisrael has sinned. They transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They took what was from the oath, they stole, they lied, and they hid it away. Wow, what an accusation. Any army would put on a pedestal such a thing that from the whole army, one person took something. So this is classic. This is just an example, which we're noting parentheses, of the way the Navi operated. The Navi blew up faults a thousandfold. And that's a very important point, just in terms of the way you approach learning Navi in general. Not to get a wrong picture of who Hashem's people were. But here is one of those classic cases where the blame is being cast on all of Klal Yisrael. All of Klal Yisrael is suffering the consequences. And this is classic. This is something that you see all throughout the Tekufa of the Navi. And it's part of the reason we don't have Nevi'im today is because we wouldn't be able to handle it. They, on their great level, the Navi was there to perfect them, to bring them to more perfection, and more perfection. This was how he did it. We wouldn't be able to handle that today. We wouldn't be able to handle the Navi's criticism. In these days, in these great days, in Yeshua Shoftim, the people know how to respond to the criticism of the Nevi'im. As time went on, the Nevi'im were resented, and that's what culminated in the Churban Bais Rishon, when the Nevi'im were oppressed for the things that they said. People couldn't hear it. But at this point, the people were able to handle it, and this was the way the Navi expressed himself. But let's just ask the question: what is the understanding? What is the understanding? How does Achan's individual, privately done Avera reflect on all of Klal Yisrael in such a way? There must be some understanding to it. So we know that there's a concept called arvos, everybody's responsible for everybody else. But what does that mean, lemaisa? How can I be responsible for things that somebody else is doing behind closed doors? So Rav Dessler and Michtav Meleo and Rav Aaron Kotler both make a mind-boggling point that really reflects what the reality of Klal Yisrael was in those days. They say as follows. I'll approach it from a mundane perspective. And this is really the point they're trying to get at. I'll use a more relatable mashal, and then we'll go back to the nimshal. Someone really upsets somebody else. Okay, I'm going to name a few responses. You tell me which are still within the realm of normal and which are not, just not on the table. Someone offends anybody, somebody else, and he yells at him. The person who was offended yells.
No.
Normal. Somebody offends somebody else, and he smashes a plate. What's that?
No.
That's already beyond. He picks something up and throws it. Beyond. Can you picture it happening? Yeah. He picks up a knife and stabs the guy. Way beyond. Okay. Now I want to tell you something. Not everywhere. I can give you a tour of neighborhoods in my alma mater, New York, of where it's not beyond. It's a socially acceptable response. Right? Now, let me just ask, in all of our homes, we say that that's just not going to happen. Now, let me ask a question. Why is it not going to happen? Is it not going to happen because when I'm provoked, I tell myself, picking up the knife is wrong. Even as upset as I am, I'm not going to stab him. Is that the process that goes through the mind? What? No. What is the process? There is no process. It doesn't enter the mind. Why doesn't it? It's just not relevant. It's not an option. Why is it not an option? Because we know it's wrong? What's that? Is it because we control ourselves? I don't think that's the real answer.
The whole surroundings are not
Exactly. That is really the answer. The superficial answer might be because we know it's wrong. That's not really what's happening in the mind. What's happening in the mind is that it doesn't enter the consciousness. Why? Because no one ever did it. Nobody does it. It just doesn't happen. It's not reality. This is the point. It's a fine point. It's a fine point, but it's such a fundamental point. Here is where our surroundings establish what our sense of normal is and what is on the table and what's not on the table when I'm considering how do I respond to a certain situation? What do I do in this case? The reality that I grew up with, that is what establishes. Because perhaps you go to some, great Musar yeshiva from the old days to say anything at all. How could a person do that? No, we're fine with that. You might yell in response. Because again, that happens in our reality. But there are things that are just not a part of the reality. And now we understand, you think about it, you realize this is really the case, and it's relevant to many other areas, many things. And this is what we understand that Hashem is trying to bring us to a place where I want you to be in a place where not that you know something is, it's wrong and therefore you control yourself. I want Klal Yisrael to be operating in a case where the reality itself and what they would consider and what they wouldn't consider is superlative. It's a very, very high place with some things, just things that we might consider today normal struggles. Hashem wants us to be in a place where those things don't even begin. It's just not. They don't enter the consciousness.
You know, like there's a certain point
Yes.
bus, like, you know, you never turn on a light on Shabbos,
That's
but
right.
you know, but for other people, oh, you know, when they're becoming mom, it's things are challenging, you
It's
know.
all this, it all connects to the same point. The reality that you put yourself in establishes what is your sense of acceptable, or even if it's not right, but it can happen. It's okay. It's normal. You're going to say something?
Why have them stop them from wiping the rest out just because it was a little slower?
Oh, okay.
Bothering.
So we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So now let's circle back to Ochran. And here, Rav Dessler and Rabban Kotler, they make a mind-boggling point, and they say that Hashem's taina was, if the Yiras Shamayim was permeating the air to the level I wanted it, it wouldn't have been a possibility at all for Ochran to do that. Now this is, it's too much for us to swallow, and it's true. We don't have to swallow that. The point here is we want to expose ourselves to the magnificence of what was and what we're hoping to get to, and to appreciate. Yes, it's true. That can't be expected of us. We are at the tail end of 2,000 years of Golus. We're very, very far from that. But let's appreciate, let's expand our horizons in terms of appreciating the potential greatness. I'm not talking about the individual now, but about Jewish society, about Jewish society. And this is what Hashem was aiming at, that what permeates the air is that Yiras Shamayim, where a person couldn't even think of sneaking it away. Now, obviously, this is something very, very fine and subtle, but this is the superlatively great chinuch process that Hashem was using with his people in order to bring them to places that we wouldn't consider realistic, that human beings wouldn't consider realistic. Now, as to your question, so the question was, if so, why did Hashem stop the process? And here, this is mamash a classic case. I just want to say this very, very clearly. What we're talking about, we're exposing ourselves to the very high standards that Hashem operated with in the early times when he was much more hands-on into the ins and outs of their chinuch, of the whole Klal Yisrael. That's how the Alter of Kelm put it. All of Hashem's criticisms, etc. It wasn't chas v'shalom, Hashem's frustration with the Jewish people. It was an old-fashioned, very high-level chinuch process. The Alter of Kelm expressed it, Hashem is the master pedagogue. So why did Hashem stop it there? Because here Hashem was conveying a lesson. You have to realize that, and this is how Hashem operated many instances when we look at the biblical times. You have to realize that opportunities don't last. And my purpose is to get you onto that level of acting energetically. You have to realize that you're going to reach places where, that's it, you won't be able to turn back the clock. And by me not enabling you to turn back the clock, what's the benefit of that? Yeah, you're going to be contending with the consequences from this point on, but you're going to be that much more on your toes. You're going to be that much more on your toes going further. And at the end of the day, what Hashem wants is that higher level of the Jewish people. If Hashem would be, so to speak, you have to realize that Hashem's, so to speak, lack of forgiveness, his very, very harsh approach, kept them operating on a very, very, very high level, which again, as time went on, the Jewish people just couldn't keep up with it. But in those days, they did. In those days, they did. And that's why we find even the Chet HaEgel. The Chet HaEgel, we see that the Bnei Yisrael did tshuva afterwards. Right? They mourned, they took off their. And yet, the Gzeira stayed in place. The Gzeira stayed in place because Hashem was after something even more important. And that is that this will remain a lesson that's going to keep them on their toes to a higher level going forward. Whereas, if Hashem would say, okay, you know what, forget about it, it's okay. The approach would be, okay, so, you know, this can happen. Everything is flexible. This was Hashem's way of keeping him in Israel at a very, very, very high level that, again, from a simple human perspective, seems unrealistic. But, and in Olam Hazeh, this was a harsh reality to contend with. We have to realize two things. Hashem's ultimate purpose was not Olam Hazeh, but Olam Habo. But number two, we have to realize that this came along with an unbelievable closeness of the Shekhinah being among us. Like we said, it was mamish, the old-fashioned relationship of a father very invested in his child's chinuch. The child was very, very keenly aware of the father's intense love, care, and dedication, and demands, uncompromising demands. But we come back to the point that we're making, and that is that the critical point in all the admonitions we see time and time again throughout the Torah, particularly in Dvarim, right, when Moshe is readying them to go and conquer Eretz Yisrael. Get rid of them, get rid of them, get rid of them, get rid of them. The point being, what? I want you to be in as pure an atmosphere as can possibly be, because then your starting point is so much higher. This is also why, for example, it says, this is a sharp point that the Brisker Rav made. It says that if a person sees a woman goes through the process that the woman was disloyal, and she goes through the process described in the Torah, what happens at the end of that process? The woman's body falls apart. Right? Everyone's familiar with the Soita Parsha, right? It says that if a person sees that happen, he should yazir, he should abstain from wine. He should take on a zeus. Why? Because wine is often the cause of such things. And therefore, take on a vow. You keep away from wine. So the question is, the person who saw it happen, he's the one who has to abstain from wine. He saw the devastating results, right? He saw the frightening results of what happened. We would say everybody else should abstain from wine. He's covered. So the Brisker Rav says something very sharp, which is actually our point here too. He says, it's not exactly true. He says, someone living somewhere else in Eretz Yisrael who knows theoretically about the concept, but it's never actually happened. He's never encountered it in his life. He's in a much purer place than the person who saw it happen and saw the devastating result. Because for this person, it's something that could happen. This goes back to the point we were saying before about, are you going to pick up a knife and stab the person? Right? He's already in a different place. It's something that could happen. It's not kedai, and that's an understatement. The results are devastating, but it's reality. It is a part of reality. He is already in a different place. He's not in the same place as the person for whom this just was never ever a part of my reality. It's theoretical, it's on paper. It might exist in parts of the world that I was never there. And this is what Hashem is trying to get us to. So again, this is discouraging if we think of it in very practical terms, because we are so far from it. But let's understand, the point here is not this great value. First of all, in understanding Hashem decided at which point in history he's putting us and what our role in history is. Our greatness is in being able to resist all that influence that we were born into. We didn't set up that situation. It's being able to resist it, to rise above it, not to beat ourselves up over realities that we didn't create. That's not the point. But the point is to be able to expose ourselves. The bigger and the more magnificent and the grander is the picture of Yiddishkeit that we understand there was, we understand we're headed to, that already will elevate us. That already will elevate us if we're working in a place with a much, much bigger and broader horizon than what we might think. So that's the purpose, being able to expose ourselves to the standards that we had then. And I'll round it off with another point, that this is a Rambam, where it says Pasuk says that if a person is megadev, it's ambiguous psukim. Pasuk says if a person does something defiantly with a raised hand, he's being megadev Hashem, he'll be cut off. Now we already have been schooled enough to know that megadev we translate into practical terms as blaspheming, as birkas Hashem. Chas v'shalom, cursing. But if you just look at the pasuk, it's just ambiguous. A person who raises a hand against Hashem defiantly, and he's megadev, okay? What exactly does it mean to raise a hand against Hashem defiantly? So, just in terms of the simple understanding, the Rambam says something fascinating. He says that what it means is, he says, we're not talking about any particular avera. Let's say a person decides he's not going to wear tzitzis, meaning he's going to transgress the chiyuv of tzitzis. He's going to wear a four-cornered garment, without tzitzis, transgressed a mitzvah. What's the punishment for it? Punishment for it is you have to do tshuva. There's no malchus, there's no mises bezdin. If bezdin know that a person is doing it on a regular basis, they'll beat him until he actually does it. But let's use that as an example of a person transgress something that is not avodah zarah gilui shpichas damim. It doesn't warrant any of the severe punishments in the Torah. But the Rambam says, okay, that's if a person goes around in his house without tzitzis. But if a person goes out in public, raises up a hand against Hashem defiantly, means that he goes out and flaunts it. I am not going to put tzitzis on. I am not going to put tzitzis on. And he steps out, makes that public. The Rambam says, well, this person has to be put to death because he is sullying, again, that pure environment where it would never cross anybody's mind. Everybody does it. There's no such thing as not doing it. Again, this is so far from our reality. We're so far from this. But the point is that in that reality, someone who comes and pokes a hole in it, today, forget about a hole. You know, about poking a hole in a balloon. Here we have the balloon that's like, you know, after it was popped, right? A couple of tatters. But in those days, when you had it all, someone came and poked a hole in it, that was considered a severe crime, regardless of the nature of the actual act he did. To poke a hole in the purity of Klal Yisrael, and the level of Klal Yisrael, and to show, well, not necessarily, that was considered a capital crime in its own right. What's that?
No.
So today, certainly not. Today, certainly not, because yeah, everybody does. You're not poking a hole. A person who goes and does that today is not poking a hole, unfortunately. That's the point. Are you changing the reality? Today, we're the ones changing the reality by wearing the tzitzis, and on the contrary, there's where we have to appreciate our role. That is the greatness of our role today, that we are mamish working in the other direction. Let's appreciate that. Don't let the air come out of you. My vocabulary is a little bit weak today, but by exposing yourself to these things, realize that yes, we are at the end of a long history and of a arduous galus that has gotten us down. Our greatness is in the fact that despite the fact that the world is what it is today, we're pushing in the other direction. We're pushing against the current. We're still holding up things that, again, the outside world in general, they'd say, come on, it's not realistic in our times. But let's appreciate where we come from and the true visions that Hashem has for Klal Yisrael in order to have our own horizons expanded and to be operating in that bigger, more beautiful picture.
Mm-hmm.